10. Hello, pod people. 20. Go to 10. Oh, is that a bit repetitive? This is Material World, now almost 100% leak moth free. And on this Podgram, which was originally a programme on the 12th of January in the year of the Apocalympics, we've got a plague of, if not locusts, then assorted other invasive pests that are now gaining a foothold, or more accurately, a tarsus hold in the UK, and our best ever image of the intangible, almost unimaginable substance which makes up over 4/5 of the universe. Plus, we'll sound out how one of the 4 finalists for So You Want to Be a Scientist is getting along with her research on which noises annoy us and why. First, my big brother Nick worked for many years at the Chalkface teaching and often said that while he encouraged pupils to use their computers to help answer questions, he'd prefer it if the work handed in didn't still contain lines like copyright Microsoft Encarta or further citations needed Wikipedia. So I'm not sure how he'll feel about suggestions that Microsoft, Google and other big technology players could become even more embedded in education as part of a radical overhaul of how computer science is taught in British schools. Education Secretary Michael Gove yesterday declared the current IT curriculum harmful and dull and announced that from September it will be replaced with something more involving that will turn out school leavers able to work at the forefront of technological change. So what does that mean? How will a new approach improve on what's currently on offer? And where do Microsoft and the other technology giants fit in? With me is Dr. Sue Black, Senior Research Associate in Computer Science at UCL. And on the line is Robert Mullins, lecturer in the Computer Laboratory at Cambridge and co-founder of the Raspberry Pi Foundation, which aims to encourage the study of computing in schools. Robert Mullins, just to avoid it hanging there, what's Raspberry Pi? And I should say that's Pi without an E, and why is it so called?
Raspberry Pi is a credit card sized computer, and we hope that it will be a catalyst to encourage children to learn about what a computer is and how to program it. The name actually comes Raspberry. It's just a tradition in the industry, really, to name computers after fruit.
Yep.
And this was one that was we liked and was untaken. And Pi comes from the Python programming language, which we hope to adopt as one of the languages that the machine will support from its launch.
Credit card sized and also less than credit card priced, I'm presuming.
So the aim was to price the machine around £20, something that children could save up with their pocket money and buy and own. So be able to buy it online, but also hope to see it bundled with books and magazines as well in the future.
OK, we'll come back to this. But in schools, we used to teach computing, then I think it was computer studies, and then it was IT, and then most recently ICT, short for Information and Communication Technologies. So why is it that Michael Gove thinks that this ICT needs warming up if it's going to become more palatable?
Well, actually, I think it's been really great to hear what Michael Gove said yesterday. I can't believe I'm saying that, because what he was saying a few months ago, I was kind of diametrically opposed to. I'm very surprised, very pleasantly surprised about what Michael Gove has said, because what's going to happen is that for a long time, people have complained about ICT in schools. And people in the tech industry are complaining that kids are leaving school with no kind of computing skills, because actually what they've been taught in ICT is mainly how to use Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, Excel, which really is kind of like what was called, I think, secretarial skills when I was at school. So it's not really computer science, it's ICT. So it's valuable, but it's not computing.
So it's become the modern version of the typing class.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. And so people have thought that that is computing, which it is not.
Yeah, and so why have we got it so badly wrong? And what did Michael Gove say to make you think that he does understand where we need to go to get it back on track?
Well, why did we get it wrong? I'm not sure. It was a government decision in the 80s. I wasn't involved in it.
I'm not blaming you.
So, it's not my fault. But what's encouraging about what Michael Gove has said is that he's acknowledged that ICT needs to be there, but that it's not computer science, where we also need to be teaching computing. And we need kids to understand the basics of programming, coding, to understand computing and computers a bit better, which I think is a great thing.
Robert,
he's also talking about using open source, which is great, because it means, you know, he's not saying that schools are going to be tied into to big companies like Microsoft to provide stuff.
And so although there is talk about involving them, there will also be these open source things around lockdown where you don't have to have any responsibilities in terms of who you pay.
Absolutely. And also he's saying that schools can decide themselves what they want to do. Government's not going to mandate exactly the curriculum, I think, understand it, which is a good thing.
Well, it's not only a good thing, it's presumably it's back to the very nature of what you can do with a computer. Yeah. Everybody can do it differently in their own way.
Absolutely.
Robert Mullins, with your university teaching hat on, have you noticed a kind of decline in how comfortable people are with coding in terms of the people applying and undergraduates?
Yes, we have, and it was one of the things that prompted the for us to start the Raspberry Pi Foundation. Many of us grew up and learned to program when during the home computer sort of boom, and at a very early age learned to program because that's all you really could do with these machines. You had to program them, and I think that exposing children to programming from an early age, builds skills and confidence. And perhaps we've been seeing people applying to university in more recent years where they don't really understand what computer science is about, and they have very limited programming experience. There is a range, but in general, I would say yes, there probably has been a drop in experience.
And it's part of the thinking of having these Raspberry Pis priced at the sort of £20 mark that people are going to... It's not the big precious thing in the house, and don't touch that, otherwise you'll break it. It's the thing you can afford to experiment with, to try new things out with. People can literally blow raspberries.
Absolutely. I think that's it. The sort of experimental part of it is very important. And there's lots of advantages of it being small and low power as well. So we envisage it being built into mobile gadgets and robots. And I think there'll be a greater sense of achievement when children are able to make the machine do something, as it looks like a piece of electronics, than perhaps there is when they drag and drop something on a modern PC. So I hope that the project element of it, the cost, the fact that they will own it and sort of customise it, and it can be interfaced to other electronic gadgets, will really draw children in and make it a fun thing for them to explore.
We've just had the 30th anniversary of the BBC Micro. Are you hoping this will have a sort of similarly galvanising effect on the youth of today?
I mean, that's our goal. It would be great to think that we could help create the next generation of computer scientists with... As computer science is so fundamental to so many of the things we do today, and will only become more important.
Sue, clearly this is something right now has got the attention of the government, and I think there's a Royal Society report on computing in education. Is there anything you'd add to the list now that you've got their attention, saying we should be doing this?
Well, there are so many initiatives around, I think, which is amazing. And now I think the key thing is to bring them all together. So that's one of the things I'm actually doing with the foundation I'm setting up called the GoTo Foundation. It's going to be a one-stop shop for people who don't know much about computer science.
OK, we'll make sure there's a link from our website. Dr. Sue Black, Robert Mullins, thank you both. At first glance, you could mistake it for a snapshot of a pond at night, mostly blacks and deep blues, but spattered with brighter patches where the ripples have caught the faint moonlight. This, though, isn't a picture of a pond or a lake or a sea or even a planet or solar system. It's something spanning millions of galaxies and countless trillions of stars. And what it shows, in far greater detail than ever before, is mysterious dark matter and the intricate pattern in which it's strewn across the cosmos. The images, there are four of them, taken in different seasons, have just been released at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Austin, Texas. And we're joined on the line from there by the team leader, Dr. Catherine Hymans from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. Catherine, I've had my go at describing the images. It's your turn now.
I think you did an excellent job, Quentin.
Yeah,
what we've seen is a giant, intricate cosmic web of dark matter spanning over about a billion light years, and it's the largest scales we've ever managed to observe dark matter.
And what do they show there? If you actually look at this image, what are the patches? What are the strands of light? What's actually in there?
So the you can see these sort of knots of dark matter. Those are the light bits that you were talking about. Those are the densest regions of the universe, and they house thousands of galaxies. And between them, we can see these wispy filaments linking it all together. So an intricate web of dark matter.
And before we plunge in any deeper, it probably is best to say what our current view of dark matter is, because I think, just over 10 years ago, certainly at the turn of the millennium, it was something you might not even find in some astronomy textbooks.
Yeah, so dark matter is a term we use for the invisible matter in our universe. Now, I said it's invisible, it's dark, but we know that it's there because of the effect that it has on the galaxies and the stars that we can see in our universe.
Do we know what it is?
Well, we have a very good theory now about what it is. We know that it's a cold particle. It only very, very weakly interacts with the particles that you and I and the Earth and the Moon and the Sun are made up of. There are lots of experiments to try and actually detect the particle, and they're finding slightly different things at the moment.
Particle singular or more than one particle?
Well, there are many, many, many dark matter particles in our universe. Only 4% of the universe is made up of the particles that you and I are made up of, and the rest of the universe is dark.
And these weird particles, I mean, this sounds a bit like, I don't mean to be too rude, but it's like the modern version of Here There Be Dragons. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's something beyond our knowledge. There's a lot of it around. We're not quite sure comfortable going there, so we stick a big label on it of dark matter or cold dark matter. Is there a sort of sense of that to it still?
Well, that's what's exciting about it. So, I mean, dark matter is only part of the dark universe that we don't understand. There's also another entity called dark energy that's stretching space at an accelerated pace, and that's even more Here Be Dragons. And that's why it's such an exciting field to be working in at the moment.
And how do these images that you've put up, how do they help us understand this further?
So this is the first time we've been able to map out dark matter on these very large cosmological scales. So we have our theories of dark matter. So I said it was a cold particle only very weakly interacting. And we can make giant simulations of what we think the universe would look like with this theory of what the dark matter particle is like. Now, those cosmological simulations we can compare now to these direct observations of dark matter, and what we're finding is that these observations are matching what we think the universe would look like if our theory of dark matter is right. So it's another confirmation of this cold dark matter theory. And also what we're finding is that the galaxies that we can see in the universe are being housed by this dark matter, which is another one of our theories, that it's the dark matter in the universe that's dictating where and when the galaxies form. And what these results are showing is sort of proof of that theory again. So it's a great theory. Our observations are showing what the theory predicts. So now it's up for our particle physics cousins to go out and find that particle.
You've several times talked about cold dark matter. And I remember about 10 years ago, the Cambridge astronomer Professor Jerry Gilmore saying, we know three things about cold dark matter. It's not cold, it's not dark, and it's not matter, which is one of my favourite one-liners. Have we improved since then?
Well, there's lots of discussion in the community about what it is. And in fact, there are in the UK, we have the Bowlby mine, which is 1,000 metres underground,
a Xenon experiment
trying to actually detect dark matter particles. There are ones in Canada and the US as well. And in fact, you know, they're finding very different things. So it's a mystery at the moment, and that's what makes it fun.
And just finally, this image, now that you've constructed it, are there further uses for it, or is that it sits on the wall and people go, that's dark matter for you?
Oh, no, that was just the highlight result that we presented at Austin today. And I think probably the next big thing is, how can we use this dark matter to understand dark energy? Because that really is a mystery. The Nobel Prize was awarded for it last year. And that's one answer of why we're seeing this accelerated expansion of the universe is, maybe we need to go beyond Einstein's theory of general relativity. Maybe we need to improve our theories of gravity. That could be one explanation for this mysterious dark universe. And that was another result we presented in Austin today. From this map, we can also understand about the mysterious dark energy.
OK, we'll come back to that another time, I think, since we can't expand on even Einstein's time there. Dr. Catherine Haymans, many thanks. It's always a little bit tricky trying to describe pictures on the radio, particularly when they're of something so weird and mind and light-bending as dark matter, but I think we should be on safer, sounder ground now, because we're about to begin an investigation into why certain noises are so upsetting and unsettling. And when I say we, it's Izzy Tomlinson, one of our So You Want to Be a Scientist finalists, who's actually doing the research. If you heard our programme at the turn of the year, you'll know the long list of 10 is now a short list of 4, each of whom has been paired with an expert to help them turn what they want to explore into a practical experiment. And Adam Rutherford was there when Izzy and her mentor met up.
We've come to the acoustics lab at the University of Salford to introduce Izzy to her scientific mentor. Izzy, now the judges were unanimous in selecting your project. Why do you think people are so interested in unpleasant sounds?
These unpleasant noises are unpleasant to so many people everywhere that it's interesting that something have such a widespread effect.
What's your most annoying noise?
Ooh, small. I think some of those sort of scrapey noises, like the traditional fingernails down a blackboard, and also chairs scraping on the floor, things like that.
Grinding teeth.
That's sort of thing.
Nice. So the next stage for the project is to turn your idea into a proper experiment. And to help you with that, we've paired you up with Professor Trevor Cox, who, amongst other things, is the keeper of the world's most hideous noises. Now, Trevor, perhaps you could show us and maybe test Izzy on some of the noises that people have decided are particularly unpleasant.
Yeah, we ran this web experiment many years ago where we uploaded 34 horrible sounds and we got people to rate how horrible they are, and hundreds of thousands of people have done it since then.
OK, Izzy, we want your reaction on a scale ranging from not horrible to horrible, going via bad, really bad, awful and really awful to the following sounds.
That's actually a real close-up recording of someone snoring, which is, for some people, an incredibly annoying sound. I must point out my wife doesn't snore at this point, so I don't suffer from this. But where would you rate it, Izzy?
Well, compared with sort of squeaky, horrible noises, it's not very annoying, but to have to go to sleep with someone making that noise all night would be quite irritating. So I'd say it's bad.
Most people give it a similar score. That sound is really dependent on when you hear it, and that's one of the problems of doing this kind of internet experiment. If you're trying to get to sleep at the moment that noise is going on, it's particularly irritating because it's stopping you doing what you want to do, go to sleep. So what makes sounds annoying doesn't just depend on the sound and its sound quality, it also depends on when you're listening to it.
So what you're saying is it's sort of context dependent. Is that something you can control for in your experiments?
It's a big problem with lots of experiments. We're sat here in our acoustics lab and we're in a special room, and you drag people into these rather weird rooms and get them to do tests. Well, the context is all wrong. So when we do tests to do with annoyance at the home, we're doing some stuff around vibration from railways at the moment, we'll mock up the room to look a bit more like a living room, so at least people feel it's a bit more like their home.
Now, is that something that you can try and deal with in Izzy's experiment? Is when you go out and do recordings or work with Trevor, maybe that's something that you can sort of factor in?
Yeah, well, I don't know where we're going to be doing these recordings, because we'd have to find quite a large group of volunteers, so maybe there's some kind of fair or something where there's a lot of people, so that might make it more difficult
to control for.
Yeah,
let's do another one. So next, and then press play. Hold on a minute, what is that? It sounds like sheep. It's babies crying.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. Actually, the sound of multiple babies crying is rather like sheep, but we'll just stop that. So what did you think on our little sort of scale of horrible smileys at the bottom? Where would you rate that one, Izzy?
I don't think that sounded very bad at all, so I'd say not horrible, just sounded like sheep.
In fact, that came up quite high up in the list of top 10 worst sounds, something like fifth or sixth. Because, of course, babies crying is something really unpleasant. It's meant to be unpleasant. The baby wants something and needs your attention. It was also one of those sounds that actually men found worse than women, mostly the other way around, so that was an interesting kind of result.
So it's easy to imagine why a baby crying would cause quite a visceral reaction or something sort of scrapey and bony. But polystyrene or plastic bags?
I've never heard of plastic bags being a horrible sound. I mean, when I did this experiment, I did get various suggestions by people, one of which was tin foil in the freezer when you're peeling that off. That would make some people go on edge. When I looked at the worst sound in the world, the worst one I came up with was someone vomiting. And that's a sort of disease avoidance thing, you know, someone being sick and you try and avoid it, try and avoid disease. Possibly the same with things like babies crying, but some of them are a bit mysterious, like rubbing polystyrene together. Why is that unpleasant?
Trevor, can you tell us a little bit about the research that's already happened in this area? What do we know about people's perception of unpleasant noises?
If we look at that archetypal bad sound, the scraping sounds, there's been a few bits of work. There's not been very much, and we know what frequencies are important in it. I mean, our ear has a particular mid-range of frequencies where we're very sensitive. It's where our speech has a lot of power, and it's also the frequencies where those scraping sounds have a lot of power. So we know what frequencies are kind of important. But we don't know too much more about why we would respond so strongly to it. So there's lots of avenues that haven't been researched that Izzy can look into.
So the next stage of the process is that you, Izzy, and Trevor have a conversation which really starts the experimental design. What questions are you going to ask? But Trevor, you're a professional academic. When you address any project, how do you start?
I think you said it there already. You've got to crystallise into a question that you think you can answer. So if, for example, Izzy wants to look at what's the effect of age on your response to scraping sounds, you've immediately got the start of an experiment. You've got to get some sounds. You've got to think about how you reproduce them. You've got to get people of different age. Then you start thinking about, well, you need to know people's hearing ranges. So how can you know what people's hearing ranges are? You would have to measure them. So you need to have access to that sort of equipment. A lot of science is about what can be done as opposed to what you'd love to do if you had a Large Hadron Collider in your back garden.
Do you have a Large Hadron Collider in your back garden?
I'm afraid I don't, actually.
No, but you've got quite a lot of recording and acoustic measuring equipment, haven't you?
Yeah, we've got cupboards full of them, so we'll be able to give Izzy lots of help.
Trevor Cox giving Izzy Tomlinson help to make all the right noises and so impress our judges and perhaps win So You Want to Be a Scientist 2012. We'll hear from another of the finalists next week. You can find out more about all the shortlisted entries to our Search for Research via the Material World web pages within bbc.co.uk/radio4. That is also the portal to our not quite as all-encompassing as that image archive of past programmes and to our various contact details, which many of you made use of following last week's Maya Maya Planets on Fire special devoted to why the supposed Mayan December 21st, 2012 doomsday prophecies are somewhat less than trustworthy. Erin Coppin thought some people might be drawn to end-of-days predictions by post-traumatic stress disorder, which can apparently leave some people unable to see themselves as having a future. Clive Neal noted that in our list of genuine threats to existence, we failed to mention that long before we're fried by the expanding sun, the Earth's core will have solidified, shutting down the magnetic field, which protects us from deadly solar radiation. Simon Reed pointed out there's an excellent and extremely funny website, How to Destroy the Earth, which details just how hard it is to obliterate our planet. There's a link to it from the Material World web pages. And finally, since we are likely to spend most of this year fending off attempts to alarm us about December the 21st, Andy Wiggins felt a special high gravitas name was needed to reflect that this could be when our species, our world, or both cease to exist.
I suggest we name this Private Fraser Day.
What a doomed. I think I'd go for Corporal Jones Day. Don't panic. Even if, as seems probable, the world is still with us come Private Fraser Day, that doesn't mean everything in the garden is rosy. There are things creeping into the flower beds that don't belong there. There are newcomers nibbling at the veg patch. The Royal Horticultural Society has today released its list of the top 10 pest inquiries for last year. And while slugs, snails, ants and the other usual suspects are all still on it, there are two new entries. One that's spreading across the country, having previously been largely confined to the south, and the other something that even 5 years ago was completely unknown in the UK. I'm joined by the principal entomologist at the RHS, Andrew Halstead. Andrew, this list isn't anything to do with expert opinion or what you at the RHS think people should be worried about. It's what the public are concerned with.
Yes, it's based on actual numbers of actual inquiries which we received last year.
And this is in the hundreds that they come in by, presumably.
If you add them all together, yes.
And the bane of my life are slugs and snails, which despite all my efforts always creep into my kind of home garden office that I work in and leave trails everywhere. I'm kind of perversely reassured to still see that they're still number one on the list as the pest. So it's kind of reassuring to know that even RHS members are troubled by them as I am.
Yes, they're fairly ubiquitous. Pretty well every garden has them. They're there in large numbers. And, of course, they also feed on a very wide range of plants, so it's quite likely that they will be a frequent inquiry.
And not getting them out of my office. Now, these two new entries on the list, which is the one that's spreading from the south?
That's something called leek moth. It's a tiny little moth which has caterpillars that feed on leek, onion, shallots and related vegetables. The caterpillars start off feeding by mining the leaves, and as they get a little bit older, they start boring into the stem of leeks and into the bulbs of onions. And it can be quite a destructive pest, particularly when it's feeding on young plants, because you get secondary rots which come in, which actually kill the plant.
But this has been established in the UK or known about for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, so it's not native to Britain. It came into the southeast, first found in Sussex around in the 1940s. And for a long time, it was confined largely to the coastal area in southeast England. But in more recent years, it has started to spread. It's spread westward and it's also moving north.
Why?
It may be climate change. It's always tempting when you see a movement like that to think, climate change is the answer. It may not be the answer, but it does sort of fit that pattern. It may be that when it first arrived here, weather conditions were such that it was confined to the more sheltered southeast coastal area. But now, with it getting milder in the winter and also longer summers, it may be able to move further out in a northward direction.
Because presumably, we're down the years, decades, centuries, we've always had weird new pests turning up in the UK because of trade and travel, but it's whether or not they can survive for very long has been the question. And if you've got milder conditions, then it's more likely they might prosper.
So there's a long tradition, a long history of new pests and diseases coming into the country. When they arrive here, they've got to, if it's a plant pest, it's got to be able to find suitable plants to feed on. And it's also got to be able to survive the weather conditions.
Now, we're having this conversation in January because the list has been published in January. And I thought this must be one of the worst times of the year to actually spot whether you've got these pests in your garden. So, but when it gets a bit later in the year, are there ways to people tell? Or they just know it must be there because my leeks died?
Well, if they grew leeks last year, they may well remember that they died off, particularly in August, which is when the second generation of caterpillars comes along. And that tends to be a bit more numerous than the first generation, so you see bigger signs of damage in August. Yes, you won't see much sign of these pests now because it is obviously bleak midwinter, but if it's in your area, it will be active again next year.
And what can you do?
Summer, rather.
What can you do?
There's not a lot you can do other than grow your leeks and onions underneath some insect-proof netting, because it's one of those situations where there isn't a suitable insecticide available for use in gardens, which can be applied on plants like leeks and onions.
And what about this other new entry, which really is a newcomer? It wasn't known about in the UK until 2007.
Yeah, the other new entrance is a little microscopic creature called the fuchsia gall mite. It originates from South America, but it's got into Europe during the last decade. And it spread to the Channel Islands, first of all, and then it moved across the Channel into England, first found in 2007. And what it does, it feeds right in the shoot tips and in the flower buds of fuchsias, and it converts the normal growth into a mass of undifferentiated tissue. And once that's happened, the plant is unable to produce any further normal growth. So it has a very obvious and a very destructive effect on the plant.
And is this just going to mean that people, gardeners, will think twice about having fuchsias?
I think they will, because, again, it's one of those pests for which there isn't a treatment. So if you've got it, all you can do is destroy the plant, and having done that, you may feel, well, it's not worthwhile buying another one to replace it.
These are just the ones that have muscled their way into the top 10, but presumably there are lots of other new pests around, possibly because of climate change.
There are, yes. There's one called the box tree moth caterpillar, which, again, is starting to spread in this country, and that's going to have quite a big impact, I think, on box topiary and hedges.
Now, I hope you won't mind me saying this, but I think you're celebrating this year 40 years at the Royal Horticultural Society. Are these things just, you know, the garden is always in flux, or are there patterns of change that you've noticed?
There are changes taking place all the time, yes. I mean, in terms of pests, we continue to get new things coming into the country. The treatments which are able to use change with great regularity. New chemicals come on, chemicals get taken off.
OK, I think we'll have to leave it there. Andrew Halstead, thank you. The changing climate can not only lead to fewer fuchsias and less leeks, OK, fewer leeks if you want to be grammatical, it can topple entire empires and the world's largest city. Next week, we'll look at new evidence that drought brought about the collapse of the Khmer Empire, which dominated Southeast Asia for four centuries, and we'll visit another of our So You Want to Be a Scientist finalists.